Okay. Good evening, everyone. So our topic for tonight is Operation Thunderbolt. In the long history of Israel's clandestine activities, by far the two most famous things that it ever did were the capture of Eichmann and the Entebbe rescue of Operation Thunderbolt. So what I want to discuss this evening is the operation from the perspective of who the bad actors were, what their motivation was, what Israel's options were in reaction to the hijacking, and sort of what was the aftermath of the operation. When it was all said and done and the hostages were home, what were the international repercussions? So the bad actors in the Entebbe hijacking were the PFLP-EO, which is a name you probably haven't heard in a long time. So the PFLP was the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which was Dr. George Habash and Dr. Wadi Haddad. And external operations refers to Wadi Haddad's organization. He was told after the 1970 airplane hijackings and blowing up of the airplanes in Dawson's Field in Jordan, don't attack targets outside of Israel. That it's bad news for the Palestinian cause if you do skyjackings and attack targets in the rest of the world. But Dr. Haddad did not want to listen to that. He wanted to be in cahoots with every revolutionary around the world, including Carlos the Jackal, who, by the way, is still alive and sitting in jail somewhere. And so Haddad established EO, External Operations, where he would take it upon himself to attack Jewish and Israeli targets and Western targets all over the world. And which brings us to 1976. Now, his ally in this endeavor was the German Revolutionary Cells, or the RZ. And together, these German Marxist revolutionaries and Palestinian terrorists were going to make a big splash, grab a plane with a bunch of Jewish passengers on board, and take it to a faraway, out-of-the-way place. So the flight in question was Flight 139 from Tel Aviv to Athens. There were it was an Air France flight. It was an Airbus A300 B4, and it departed for Paris from Athens on June 27th, 1976. So it had a from Tel Aviv to Athens to Paris. It left Athens around 12:30 in the afternoon. At that time, four terrorists got on board. Who were these terrorists? So now let's get to the identity of who the bad actors were. Two of them were PFLP operatives, Palestinians, Abdul Rahim Jaber and Jalal Najat Rahon. Say that 10 times. They've been forgotten by history. The more famous ones were the Germans. The Germans, Wilfried Bose, who was a 27-year-old guy born in 1949, and was one of the founders of the RZ, a left-wing terrorist, a revolutionary. During the course of the hijacking, he was confronted by Shoah survivors, by Holocaust survivors. This was especially after they made the separation between the Jewish and non-Jewish passengers, and he was confronted. You're doing just like what the Nazis did, and his response was, "I'm no Nazi. I'm an idealist." And later on, we shall see he was reluctant to shoot hostages. So he died in this operation. He died at the age of 27, a bad guy. But we should acknowledge that he never shot a hostage. He shot Israeli soldiers in the shoot in the firefight and then got killed. But he did not regard himself as an anti-Semite. He regarded himself not as a Nazi, but as an idealist and a left-wing revolutionary. His compatriot and one-time girlfriend was Bridget Kuhlmann, born in 1947. Okay, so she dies at the age of 29. And her story in this whole affair was that she was known as the Nazi terrorist. She was a vicious anti-Semite, and throughout the whole ordeal was barking orders in German and saying horrible anti-Semitic tropes, verbal abuse of the passengers, pistol whipping passengers. She took pleasure in inflicting pain and suffering on the civilian hostages. So the guy really didn't. I mean, he was a bad guy, but she was far worse than he was. Okay. Where did they come from? So they got on a plane in Bahrain and landed in Athens. And then The four of them got on this Air France flight with their weapons in their suitcases, which they took with them on the plane. So it wasn't stowed below deck, but rather on the carry-on luggage, they had their weapons with them. Now you could ask, well, how did they get the weapons on board? Were the airport security officers in Athens in cahoots with them? And the answer is there was hardly any security at all. Now, in the fictionalized movie version of Operation Thunderbolt, if you recall watching the movie, so they turn off the circuit breakers in the airports to the magnetometers. So there are metal detectors, but they were off for a few minutes, and the airport security just filed people through because they didn't want the plane to be delayed. I'm not sure that is historically accurate. I've tried to look into that over the years, and I think it may be fictional. Just the movie script called for something, and that was in it. Okay, but however they got their weapons on board, they did. About 20 minutes after takeoff from Athens, that's when all hell breaks loose on the plane, and there's a threat to blow up the plane. There are grenades with the pins pulled and pistols drawn. So there's a thought on the part of some of the passengers to rush the terrorists, overpower them, and retake the plane. That didn't come to pass. Instead, Bose got to the cockpit and he put a gun to the pilot's head, and the pilot had to do the biddings of the terrorists. So Michael Bekos was the pilot, was a tzaddik, was a good man. We'll learn more about him later in the lecture. But so he's under coercion and has to do what they tell him. Where do they want to take the plane? The answer is, well, nobody knows just yet from the passenger perspective, and certainly Israel doesn't know where the plane is headed. But the Israeli transportation authorities knew almost immediately that there was a problem because of the lack of radio communication and falling off the expected radar signals. So the plane goes to Benghazi in Libya. Why Libya? Well, Libya is a home to terrorist haven. The regime there was certainly not going to cause any trouble for PFLP hijackers, so it was a place to refuel. But where to go from there? So the plane didn't leave Benghazi for a while. The people were stuck on the plane with no food, no fresh water, and the air was getting stifling hot. Remember, it's in the middle of a desert, so this was really torturous. For the passengers. Now, one passenger, Patricia Martel, who was a dual Israeli and British citizen, she pretended to have a miscarriage and was allowed off the plane because the female terrorist, Bridget Kuhlman, basically came to the conclusion that if we have a miscarriage and it gets all messy and gross, it'll be too complicated for the hijacking operation. So better to get this lady off the plane. As it turned out, Patricia Martel was not even pregnant. She just concocted this story to get off the plane because she wanted to get to London, where her father was gravely ill, and her mother had recently passed away. So she was on the way and wanted to get off the plane. It turned out that Patricia Martel actually had seen Idi Amin. We're going to see Idi Amin, the president of Uganda, who plays a horrible role in all of this, and was a facilitator of the hijacking. So Idi Amin previously had good relations with Israel in the early 1970s, before Israel broke off relations with him shortly before the Yom Kippur War. And Idi Amin spent time in Tel HaShomer Hospital as a patient, having had some surgeries and procedures. And Patricia Martel actually was his nurse in Tel HaShomer because she was the only nurse who spoke English because she was a British citizen. So she later was interviewed, and they asked her, "Had you been not gotten off the plane, faking the miscarriage, and ended up in Uganda, what do you think would have happened?" And she said, "I would have gone over to Idi Amin and said, 'Hi, hey, you remember me?'" And then and she thought his reaction would be to stab her to death. Okay, so she was happy she wasn't there. All right. Well, in Benghazi, food and some water was brought onto the plane. The passengers were unhappy to say the least, but they were given some sustenance, and then the plane got off the ground again. It went back in the air with a full tank of gas. Where was it headed? There was always the possibility that it was headed back for Tel Aviv, going back to Israel. There was a thought that it could be like a kamikaze plane to crash into some Israeli building, which in a previous lecture I had mentioned was at one time been a PLO plan, a Black September plan to crash planes into buildings in Tel Aviv. So the IDF and airport security at Ben Gurion was getting ready for the possibility that this plane was coming back to Israel and that there might need to be a commando operation along the lines of the Sabina operation of 1972, where commandos from Sayeret Matkal pretended to be airplane technicians and snuck onto the plane and then overpowered the terrorists. But that wasn't meant to be this time. Instead, the plane went southward and it landed in Uganda at Entebbe International Airport. Entebbe being a small little town about 20 miles away from Kampala, which is the capital of Uganda, right on Lake Victoria. So that's where the plane ends up. It gets there later in the day on Monday, June 28th. Monday, June 28th. So this is day two. Well, big question is the regime in Uganda cooperating with the terrorists or not? The Ugandan version of the story, as told at the United Nations a week later, after this whole thing was over and done with, actually 2 weeks later when the whole thing was over and done with, was that Uganda was not in cahoots with the PFLP. Rather, the plane was running low on fuel, and as a humanitarian gesture, the regime of Idi Amin allowed the plane to land. And then was told to stay out of the terminal because the hijackers had booby-trapped the terminal and had put grenades and threatened to explode it. And so the Ugandans were acting in good faith the whole time. That's a big lie. Okay, it's a bit about as big as lies you could possibly tell. But the Ugandan representatives in the UN on July 9th, after it's all over, would say that would spin that kind of yarn, a phony baloney story about how the Amin regime was not complicit. The reality was they were entirely complicit, and there were workers at the airport and members of the Ugandan military who knew ahead of time that the terrorists were coming and who were preparing for them and preparing food for the hostages who they knew they would have to feed. So this was well coordinated ahead of time with the cooperation of Uganda. Okay, so the Entebbe Old Terminal was no longer in use, and the hostages were put there. How many hostages were there? There were 260, 248 passengers, 12 members of the crew. So it's a lot of people, a lot of human beings, and they have to be taken care of. Idi Amin Dada, the president, general, doctor, president Idi Amin Dada, field marshal, give him whatever title you want. He had 1,000 different titles, and he wore them all on his chest. Okay. He was a lunatic, he was a nutcase. But he was the president, and you had to respect him. If you didn't call him by all of his titles, he would smack you. So he would visit every day and welcome, and as soon as he would walk in, he would say, Shalom, Shalom, because he knew Abyssal Hebrew because of the years in Israel. He wanted to pretend as though he was the savior of the hostages. That was his role that he was playing, but it was all an act. He was not the savior of the hostages by any stretch. Okay. So, of course, the next phase in this process is to figure out what the terrorists want. What are their demands? And the question is whether the Israeli authorities are ready to capitulate and give in to those demands. Now, even before we know what the demands are, in general, the policy had been not to negotiate with terrorists. That had been Golda Meir's policy when she was prime minister, and it had been the policy earlier than that as well. So now, under the administration of Yitzhak Rabin as prime minister and Shimon Peres as defense minister, Yigal Alon as foreign minister, what are they going to do? If you don't negotiate and there are threats to the lives of the hostages, the alternative is some sort of military operation. But a military operation 2,500 miles away from Israel is no simple thing. It's one matter to invade Lebanon with a strike force, and go up the beaches of Beirut and get in a little dinghy boat and go back to Haifa. You're there in 20 minutes. But to go 2,500 miles, that's a long way. So big question, what do the Ugandans want? And how much is Israel willing to capitulate? So The demands turned out to be $5 million ransom for return of the Air France plane, and then the release of 53 prisoners. Of the 53 prisoners, 40 were in Israeli jails, and 13 were elsewhere, including in Germany, Switzerland, and United Kingdom. Who were these 13 others? So, you could look up if you read the articles about Operation Thunderbolt, you'll scroll down a little bit. You look for the names of the requested prisoners. Mostly, they were left-wing communist Marxist German revolutionaries and their compatriots. So, mostly Palestinian PFLP PLO prisoners and a bunch of German revolutionaries. Well, the ultimatum was if the various prisoners and the money is not released by Thursday, July 1st, at noontime, the hostages will be killed one at a time over some stretch of time, but will start killing people very, very soon. Now, these demands are made known on Tuesday morning, so there's only about 48 hours to figure out what you're going to do. Then, on June 29th, on Tuesday, the separation, the Selektion happens. And this is where the hostages got very, very nervous because the Jews were separated from the Gentiles. All the passports had been collected, and the non-Israeli and non-Jewish passengers were going to be in one room, the Jews and Israelis in another room. They broke down a wall and sent the Jews into to the left. Okay? So this reminded the Holocaust survivors of the selection at Auschwitz-Birkenau, and really scared them out of their minds. They thought we're all going to die. Who was taken to which group? So obviously, if you were not an Israeli citizen and didn't have a Jewish-sounding name, then you were going to be kept with the Goyish passengers. If you were an Israeli Jew, you were of course going to go with the Jews. But what if you were a dual citizen? You had an Israeli passport, Jew or non-Jew, you had an Israeli passport, but you also had an American passport, a French passport, a British passport. Were the terrorists going to be respectful of the rights of the citizens of those other countries, even though you happen to have an Israeli passport? Or was your status as a quasi-Israeli going to doom you to be kept with the Jews? Also, what if you were a non-Israeli Jew? That you had a Talisman tefillin in your bag and they saw it, but your passport said you were an American or you were a Frenchman. What happened then? So these were the confusing features of the whole separation. As it turned out, there were five non-Israeli Jews, and they were forcibly added to the Jewish group. There were three non-Israelis who volunteered to join the Jewish group, or it wasn't known that they were Israelis by the terrorists, and they were not coerced, but they did so on their own. One of them was Janet Almog. Janet Almog, who was married to an Israeli named Ezra, actually had an Israeli passport, but they didn't know it. As far as she was, they were concerned, she was just an American, and she wanted to stay with her husband. The husband said, "No, get out of here. I'll meet you in London." But there was a commotion. The couple was fighting with each other, and when the terrorists heard the commotion, they said, "What's going on here?" And they realized what was happening. This was a married couple, and she was a Jew and married to an Israeli. They said, "No, you have to stay." So that's the selection process. What about the release of the non-Jews? So on June 30th, on Wednesday, 48 passengers were released. Who were these passengers? Mostly the elderly, the sick, the small children. So non-Jews, non-Israelis who were more problematic from a humanitarian point of view for the hostage takers to continue to hold on to. So those people were allowed to go first. But then on July 1st, there was a further release of hostages. 100 more were released. Why? Because Israel agreed to negotiate. That Israel was desperate for an extension of the deadline, so they agreed in principle to negotiate, maybe in bad faith, maybe in good faith, but probably in bad faith. And all that remained behind was 106 people. Of the 106, 84 were Israeli Jews, 10 were Frenchmen, and 12 were members of the crew. Okay, so the big question is, what did the terrorists think was going to happen? I mean, Did they really think Israel was going to capitulate? I don't know. I'm not sure that the terrorists on the ground really were thinking anything. They were just the henchmen, the goon squad for Wadi Haddad, who it is in his hideout was dictating orders. He was hoping for some kind of an Israeli capitulation, but it wasn't happening. It was just further talking and talking and talking, diplomatic wrangling. Who tried to get in on the diplomatic wrangling? Anwar Sadat, as a go-between between the Americans and the PFLP. Even Yasser Arafat tried to get in on the act because he felt he was being left out. He likes to be the big hero for the Palestinian cause, and here somebody else, a renegade Palestinian faction, was getting all the headlines. So these efforts at diplomatic intervention really, really didn't work. They didn't work. Did Israel have any connections with Idi Amin to try to speak to him? Well, the answer is yes, because Amin had been, a player on the Israeli scene just a few years earlier. So they had a friend of Idi Amin's, Baruch Burka Barlev, former Israeli officer, high-ranking Israeli officer, who was a friend of Idi Amin's, call him multiple times to see what could be done to try to get the release of the hostages. But Amin was a nutcase. He really was erratic. The one thing he wanted most out of all this was international attention. He wanted the spotlight on him and for him to be seen as playing something of a constructive role, even though he really wasn't. Okay, so Amin was happy actually that the deadline was extended from July 1st to July 4th. It meant he got three more days on the front page of the New York Times. All right. Well, in the Israeli government, there was a divide about what to do. Yitzhak Rabin favored diplomatic negotiations. Shimon Peres, the defense minister, assumed all along that those would fail, and he preferred a military action. Of course, no military action was going to be possible unless there was sufficient intelligence to make it viable, that it would likely succeed. They were not going to send the commandos 2,500 miles away to fall into some kind of a trap. It would have to be a well-laid plan based upon solid information, solid intelligence. Okay. So the extension was till July 4th, and the purpose was to allow Idi Amin to go to the big meeting, the annual meeting of the Union, the Organization of African Unity, which later became the African Union. So the Organization of African Unity, and he was the president of the conference, but was handing off the presidency to the next guy from Mauritius. So the meeting was on the island of Mauritius, off Madagascar. And Israel, knowing that Amin was out of the country for a few days, but was coming back probably either on Saturday night or Sunday morning, realized that that's the time to strike. If you're going to have a military action, it's going to have to happen Saturday night going into Sunday morning. But in order to do this, Israel needed help. It couldn't do it alone. It needed help from some East African country. Why? Refueling. Israel doesn't have the planes to go 2,500 miles in one direction, go down onto the tarmac, scoop up the hostages, pick up whatever equipment, and then fly home. It needs to be able to refuel. Aerial refueling was an impossibility because we're dealing with Hercules C-130 planes that they just couldn't do it, given the circumstances. There is aerial refueling capability, but not in this kind of a mission that far away. So, which African country was going to be willing to cooperate? The answer is none of them really were so forthcoming because they didn't want to stoke the wrath and the ire of Idi Amin. Who knows what he'll do in response to the backstabbing by siding with the Zionist Jews. But Kenya ultimately decides to help. Kenya, which is a neighbor of Uganda, and the ideal place from which to refuel and to take care of business. They agreed to help out. Why? So, a few factors. Relations with Kenya had been pretty good up until the Yom Kippur War. It kind of soured after the Yom Kippur War, but then in 1976 and onward, they were rekindled. The key player in this was former Minister of Agriculture, Bruce Mackenzie. Now, with a name like Bruce Mackenzie, how is he a minister in the government in Kenya? The answer is he's a white guy, one of the few white guys who post-independence was able to retain a position in government. He was a friend of the Jews. He helped Israel when it came to a terrorist incident earlier that year, where there was an attempt to shoot down an LL plane. Okay, so Bruce McKenzie was able to convince the Attorney General, to convince the Prime Minister, that Israel should be allowed to use Nairobi Airport for refueling, and to use the terminal as basically a makeshift hospital, that in case there are injuries in the result of the commando raid to rescue the hostages, that they should be allowed to be treated at that airport. Okay, so this was a big mitzvah that Bruce McKenzie did. Sadly, because of his mitzvah, Idi Amin had him assassinated 2 years later. So at the age of about 59, he died in a plane crash. He was going from Uganda back to Kenya, and a bomb was placed under his seat, and it blew up the whole plane and killed a bunch of people. So for his mitzvah, he died. But the Mossad dedicated a forest in the Galilee in his memory after he died. Okay. Well, what's happening? So there is a plan. There's a plan to send four C-130 aircraft, big hulking aircraft, to land at the airport, and to have two Boeing 707s land in Nairobi, go to Nairobi. One to set up the hospital, the other would take off again from Nairobi and circle in the air above Entebbe while the commandos and the Hercules are on the ground rescuing the hostages. So six planes total, one only going to Nairobi, four landing in Entebbe, one landing in Nairobi and flying over in Entebbe and going back to Nairobi. Okay. Well, the question is, did Idi Amin know about this? Was the information leaked? I mean, a lot of people in Israel knew what was going to happen. People in Kenya knew what was going to happen. MI6 knew what was going to happen. The Americans found out at the last minute what was going to happen. Did Idi Amin know it? And there's some evidence to suggest that he was told that something was about to occur, but that he dismissed it. Others say, no, he knew it was going to happen, and he told his forces not to fire on Israeli troops. But that's baloney, because they did fire. So I'm not really sure whether Idi Amin had advanced knowledge of this or not. We know that after it happened, he didn't know that it had happened. It was in the middle of the night, he was sleeping, and he was caught off guard. He got a phone call from Barlev and didn't know what Barlev was talking about. But the whole thing was over before Amin even found out about it. Okay. So how did Israel have sufficient intelligence to be comfortable doing this raid? Several factors. One, Solel Boneh, the Israeli construction company, had built the old Entebbe terminal, so they had the plans. That's pretty important. A second factor was the Mossad sent agents to scout out the place over Lake Victoria in the days preceding the operation. Thirdly, there were over 100 people who were taken hostage who had been there who were released. And they were released to France. So the Mossad sent people to debrief them, and they took all this intelligence they got from the released hostages. So with all this information in mind, there was plenty to go on to put together some kind of an operation. Well, a replica of the Entebbe terminal was built in Israel for practice runs, and they were told, faster, faster, faster. You got to do it faster, because the goal was in and out of 90 minutes. In the end, it ended up being 53 minutes. Okay. So who's going to run this operation? Dan Shomron, who would go on to become the Israeli chief of staff, the Ramatkal of Tzahal, was the overall ground commander. The assault team leader, the assault team which had 29 members from Sayeret Matkal, was led by Yoni Netanyahu, and his deputy was Muki Betzer, who would take over after Yoni died, sadly. Okay, where are they going to fly from? They're going to fly from Sharm el Sheikh. Now, this is important. Remember, this is 1976. It's not 1966. It's not 1986. If it were 1966 or 86, there's no Sharm el Sheikh. It's only because it's 1976 that Israel controls the Sinai, which means that the flight from Israel to the heart of Africa is a lot shorter. If they had taken off from Eilat or from the Ramon Air Base somewhere in the Negev, the flight is a lot longer. But because Sharm el Sheikh is all the way down, the flight is considerably shorter. Okay. Final authorization for the operation did not occur until after the planes had already taken off. There was a sort of a drop dead hour beyond which they couldn't go. They would have to leave at a certain point in time, Saturday late in the day, and if they had left any later than that, the operation was not really tolerable. So they were waiting for the Rabin administration to say, yes, go ahead. In the air, they got the signal. Well, they landed at Entebbe at around 11 p.m. The goal was to fool the Ugandans into thinking that this was not an Israeli rescue operation, but rather was Idi Amin arriving back from Mauritius. And so there was a black Mercedes. Anyone who's seen the movies or seen the pictures knows the black Mercedes, okay, with a bunch of Israeli commandos sitting in the Mercedes. It was supposed to be a replica of Amin's actual car because he had a Mercedes. The problem was that he had just bought a white Mercedes and replaced the black one. So the guys on the ground at the airport knew that. The Israelis didn't know that. It sort of messed up everything. There was actually a lookalike, a large co Israeli commando, a big bulky guy, 300-pound guy, who painted his face black and was going to pretend to be Idi Amin. But in the last second, they chose not to do that because they were afraid if they had a guy who looked like him, someone from his own team, friendly fire from Sahal, would shoot him. So they used the Mercedes to try to fool the Ugandans, but they didn't use the dummy, the lookalike. Okay. The hatch was open on the plane even before it landed from the first Hercules, and the Mercedes rolls out. The goal was not to fire on the Ugandan guards if you didn't have to. Try not to kill them, and also not to cause a firefight too soon before the commandos reached the terminal. The goal was to prevent gunfire before getting really, really close to the terminal. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way. Some of the Ugandan guards, at some distance from the terminal, realized something was afoul, and they pulled their weapons. And so some people in the cars fired with silencers at the Ugandan guards, killing them. But then somebody else opened fire with a machine gun, and it wasn't silenced. So now there was a commotion, and all hell's going to break loose. But nonetheless, despite gunfire and commotion, the commando team runs on foot the last distance, last 50 meters, to get to the terminal. And with a megaphone, they yell in Hebrew and in English, "Get down. Tzahal is here. The Israeli soldiers are here. Get down." The fear was that many hostages would die in a firefight between the terrorists and the IDF, that many hostages would, get caught in the middle and get hit and die. It was fully expected they could lose 25 to 30 hostages. That didn't happen, but it wasn't without its casualties. So there were three who died during the raid. They were Jean-Jacques Maimoni, who was a French Jew who had recently made Aliyah. He was only 19 years old. Pascal Cohen, 52 years old, and Ida Borukhovitz, who was 56, was a Russian Israeli. Of the three of them, I believe two were killed by the terrorists' fire, and one was killed with friendly fire from Tzahal. So, what happens when the German and the Palestinian terrorists realize that the IDF is out to get them? So, number one, they didn't see it coming. They really were caught off guard. Boze, the German man, he only fired at soldiers and told the hostages to get into the bathroom and lie down, head for cover. So his goal was actually to keep the hostages alive and to keep himself alive, but he died in the firefight very quickly. The rest of the Palestinian terrorists were killed when grenades were thrown into the bathroom where they were hiding. So within a few minutes, all of the hijackers were dead. Then the problem was Ugandan soldiers, and the Ugandan soldiers begin firing from the control tower, and they hit Yoni Netanyahu in the back, and he died. He died in surgery on the airplane on the way back. Five other soldiers were hit. There was a big machlokas afterward as to who was responsible for Yoni's death, meaning why was it that they couldn't neutralize the control tower earlier and that Yoni had to, get hit and get killed. They did ultimately neutralize the control tower by shooting a bazooka at it and blowing it up and killing a whole lot of Ugandans. So, how many Ugandans died in this operation? We don't know. One estimate on the low end was about 45. On the high end, it was estimated about 100. However, you have to realize that we'll never know for sure because even if you know how many died in total, some of them died during the operation, which lasted about a half hour before it was pretty much over. But many, many more died when Idi Amin, in anger over what had happened, started executing people left and right. So many, many people died. Ugandans died because Idi Amin was crazy and was infuriated by what had happened. Okay. So on the ground, they were on the ground for only 53 minutes. Aside from rescuing the hostages, there were other things to accomplish. One was to take some evidence of the crimes back home. The other was to blow up the Ugandan MiGs so that the Ugandan Air Force could not chase after the Hercules planes on their way out of the country. That was part of the complaint against Israel after the fact that Israel engaged in essentially a military operation against Uganda, not just a hostage rescue attempt. But, too bad. Okay, so there is one a further casualty that needs to be mentioned. Five Jews died. The three I mentioned in the crossfire, Yoni Netanyahu, the only IDF casualty, being shot from the control tower, and the last was Dora Bloch. So Dora Bloch was a British Israeli citizen, 75 years old, had been born in Ottoman Palestine, was married to a British Jew and therefore had British citizenship. She was traveling to London with her son, Ilan Hartuv. Hartuv, I believe, is still alive. I think he's still alive. He was the one who gave a lot of the testimony for all the books and articles that were written after the fact. So Dora Bloch supposedly choked on a chicken bone that she while she was eating in Entebbe, one of them, the bad meals that they served them in the airport. And she was taken to Kampala Hospital. She was visited by British diplomats both before and after the hostage rescue effort. So the Ugandans would later claim that Israel took her home with them. But that's a lie, among many lies that the Ugandans would tell after the fact. We know that the British Consul General in Uganda, in Entebbe, was permitted to see her after the IDF raid was over. So she was still alive then. What happened to her? Amin was so furious about what had occurred that he ordered her assassinated. He ordered her murdered. And so his goon squad came to the hospital. And when the nurses and the doctors tried to prevent the assassins from killing her, they killed the nurses and the doctors too. And they killed Dora Bloch. How was she killed? It's unclear whether she was suffocated to death or she was shot, but she was taken to a sugar plantation about 20 miles outside of town, and her body was dumped there. Later on in 1979, after the Amin regime was overthrown, her body was re recovered, and she was buried in Har HaMenuchot in Israel. With a major funeral services for her reburial. Okay. What else happened after the Israelis left? The answer is 245 U Kenyan Ugandans, and it's Kenyan citizens living in Uganda, were rounded up and massacred. And 3,000 more realized that we're going to be next because Idi Amin is crazy, so they left the country. So major, major death as a result of this, courtesy of Idi Amin's brutality and barbarism. Okay. On July 9th, 1976, the United Nations Security Council took up the issue of Operation Thunderbolt, which was renamed Operation Yonatan Mivtza Yonatan in honor in memory of the deceased Yoni Netanyahu. Well, it was the Ugandan foreign minister duking it out with Chaim Herzog, Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. And by the way, in the long history of the United Nations, there have been three really impressive speakers. And who have they been? Daniel Patrick Moynihan, Abba Eban, and Chaim Herzog. Okay? Those have been, in my opinion, the most impressive speakers in UN history. Chaim Herzog would go on to become the president of the state, son of the former chief rabbi, the father of the current president, himself the head of the Amman and military intelligence in an earlier part of his career. So it was his task to defend Israel when a motion was filed by Tanzania and some African states on behalf of Uganda, criticizing Israel for violating Ugandan territorial integrity and violating its sovereignty. So they told their version of the story, in which Idi Amin is a good guy and did no wrong. Herzog methodically, point by point, proved that the Ugandan regime was in cahoots with the terrorists, that at many times over the course of the week, the Palestinians and Germans had left the terminal and the hostages were being guarded only by Ugandan soldiers. Okay? And that Amin was not the protector of the hostages, but rather had facilitated the capture in the first place. And then he killed Dora Block. So all this was proven, very conclusively by Chaim Herzog in his speeches. In the end, no resolution was adopted in either direction, not condemning the PFLP and not condemning Israel. Where was world sympathy on this issue? So the Western countries generally did view the raid favorably as a bold and daring rescue attempt for the good of humanity and for the good of welfare of civilian hostages. So yes, quietly, Western countries give a yasher koach, a pat on the back to Israel. But publicly, many of those very same countries were reluctant to issue any, declarations of support for Eretz for Medinat Yisrael because they didn't want to kindle the wrath of East African countries, not Idi Amin and anybody else. So publicly, this was a not very much to be applauded, only privately to be applauded. Okay. Who was rewarded? Who suffered from all this? Well, Michael or Michel Bekos, the pilot, who together with the other 11 members of the crew had volunteered to stay behind and heroically, risk their lives to protect the endangered Israeli and Jewish members of the passenger roster. They could have gone home to France, but they chose to stay. This was their version of a Kiddush Hashem. They heroically and bravely risked their lives. So Bekos was given the French Legion of Honor, and after a 2 week vacation, he was back on the job. And he, at his request, his very first flight when back on the job was where? To Israel. He wanted to go back. He wanted he died at the age of 85 in at the age of 95 in 2019. He died 5 years ago. And at his funeral, they played Hatikva. So, a very touching tribute upon his death many years later, they played Hatikva. There was a postscript to this whole episode, and that of the bombing in Nairobi in 1980. There was a hotel, the Norfolk Hotel, which was owned by members of the Jewish community of Nairobi, Kenya. A small Jewish community has existed there for a long time, business people doing business in East Africa, mostly Israelis. And the hotel was bombed by Palestinian terrorists in 1980 and killed 20 people and injured 100 others. This was payback against Kenya and the city of Nairobi for having been in cahoots with Israel to rescue the hostages in 1976. Another little postscript to all this is that the relationship between Shimon Peres and the Netanyahu family was forever cemented and bonded by what happened, because Peres spoke at Yoni's funeral. You can watch the eulogy. It was a short eulogy, but a very, very eloquent one and very meaning, heartfelt one. It's available on YouTube in the Hebrew. You can watch it. And Benzion Netanyahu, the father, the professor, was touched by Peres's presence there, and the surviving brothers, Bibi and Ido, were became friends effectively of Shimon Peres, despite being on ideologically other sides of the aisle. Peres being a stalwart of labor, and the Netanyahu family being Irgunists and Likudniks, they had this friendship, This friendship, of course, was tested 20 years later, because what happened? Bibi ran against Shimon Peres for the prime ministership. In the first ever direct election of prime minister in Israel, they went head to head, and Bibi won by a vote of 50.1% to 49.9%. That'll test any friendship. Okay. Now, the story of Operation Thunderbolt is very well known, even outside of Israel, or was for a good few decades, because of the press coverage it received. It was a major world story, but also because of the movie versions which were put out. And within less than a year, maybe 6 months of the events of 1976, two movies came out, an English version and a Hebrew version. The Hebrew version won, was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. So the Hebrew version was called Mivtza Yonatan, and it starred Yehoram Gaon as Yoni Netanyahu. And the theme song was the music for Eretz Tzvi, which later became the melody for Mishaberach for Tzahal. And once you hear that melody, you can't unhear that melody. It's in your head forever. The English version was Operation Thunderbolt, came out early 1977. And the star of the show was playing the role of Dan Shomron, was Charles Bronson of Great Escape fame and Death Wish fame. And Idi Amin was played by Yaphet Kotto. Now, if you know, Yaphet Kotto was a Jew, was a black Jew, a big hulking guy. He died, I think, a couple of years ago. But it's funny that he, a Jew, a black Jew, played the role of Idi Amin. Shalom, shalom, everybody. And who played Menachem Begin, who had a very limited role in the whole story, because Menachem Begin was the head of the opposition in Israel at the time. His only role was that Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister, informed Begin of the fact that a raid was going to happen before, just before it happened, and got Begin's blessing and approval for it. That Begin was played by none other than David Apatoshu. Now, if you know your movie history, David Opatoshu played Akiva Ben Kanan in Exodus with Paul Newman in 1960. So David Opatoshu played basically the Vladimir Jabotinsky, Menachem Begin-style Irgunist character in two different movies. I guess that was done on purpose. All right. In the long run, what was the significance of Operation Thunderbolt? The goal was to prove that if you attack citizens of Israel or Jews anywhere in the world, that Medinat Israel exists to defend world Jewry and will go to the ends of the earth, to the middle of nowhere, in the heart of Africa, for the sake of defending its people. That, in the long run, was the Jewish lesson and the significance of Israel as a state to be derived from this story. But one of the things that Chaim Herzog at the UN, and even Rabin in some of his statements also tried to get across, was that for the free world, this was something to be applauded, that international terrorism, and by the way, international terrorism is really just a code word for Palestinian terrorism, because that's most of what most terrorism was, Palestinian terrorism. But international terrorism is a scourge that affects decent human civilization. And that something has to be done to fight back against it, because up until that time, Western countries had been capitulating too easily. I mean, we know from 1972, from the Munich episode, that the German government was very quick to release the bad actors of Munich to exchange for the hostages from the Lufthansa flight, and some say it was all done on purpose. It was a scam. So Western governments had a habit of not engaging the terrorists militarily, but rather giving up to the terrorist demands. And you can't do that forever, because if you keep doing that, then the bad guys will keep hitting you hard, and you'll have to capitulate again and again and again. So Israel tried to have Western countries learn the lesson that they too have to engage the enemy like Israel did, with an aggressive military response, and not just with a weak-kneed diplomatic or pathetic response. Okay, so that's what we'll stop here. Any questions? We'll take the questions. Unmute. Okay, anybody want to ask a question? Go right ahead. Yes, no. Okay, we're good. All right, folks, then in 2 weeks, we'll be back in business. For our next session, it will be about the bombing of the Iraqi nuclear plant. All right,
Not
folks,
mine.
take care. Yeah, Asher.
Yeah, just the observation I put in the chat that it was very awe-inspiring to see the crew that refusing to leave their passengers, the Jewish passengers.
They were tzaddikei umot ha'olam, the righteous among the nations.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, folks, take care.